is the United States versus Stanciu. Mr. Gutierrez.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Gerardo Gutierrez on behalf of Ovidiu Isaac. First, Judge, I want to apologize for my tardiness this morning. I don't have a valid excuse. I wasn't here. Judge, we raised two issues in this case, and that is that, one, my client should not have been given the 4 points for leader organizer based on extraneous information that was submitted to the court. We're claiming that that information may or may not have prompted the judge to issue the 4 points enhancement. And then the other part I think we share with counsel, and that is that the court didn't give much credit to our argument that he should have been given favorable consideration because he was ultimately going to be deported for an aggravated felony, and he's a non-citizen of the United States. As to the first issue, I believe that that issue deals with information concerning an organized trip to Las Vegas and then to California, where it was claimed that my client orchestrated a sort of a gang activity of bringing people down there to collect a debt in furtherance of this offense. In the first issue, we claim that my client didn't orchestrate such a move to go down to collect the debt. And secondly, that if he wasn't acting in concert with other cohorts, that he did not go down there to collect the debt in furtherance of this case, and that the court impermissibly gave some weight to that argument and gave him a 4-point increase on that. We're claiming, Judge, that, you know, we're not saying that there wasn't some evidence to suggest that my client was a leader organizer. We're just saying that the court may have considered this extraneous evidence to reach that conclusion, and that that should have been properly omitted from the calculus of his sentencing. I can move on to the different subject, which is that, you know, this is a typical case where a resident alien undertakes to commit a crime, and then that crime, because of the amount, certainly of the fraud in this case, well over $10,000, that he is presumptively removable from the United States as an aggravated felon, and that the court should have at least addressed the merits of the argument that because he is more than likely going to be deported following his term of incarceration, that the court should have sentenced him somewhere either below the guideline range or at the lower end of the
guideline. Counsel, what do you have to say about Ramirez-Fuentes?
Well, Judge, I don't believe that Ramirez-Fuentes controls in this case.
Why not?
Well, because
Ramirez-Fuentes holds that this is a stock argument, that it's functionally worthless, and the district judges are entitled to ignore it. Your brief says that the district judge didn't discuss this argument. That appears to be wrong. The district judge did. But Ramirez-Fuentes says that the judge doesn't have to. There's no principle under which district judges have to give removable aliens a discount on their crime. Now, given Ramirez-Fuentes, this appeal appears to be frivolous. That's why I asked you how you could reconcile your position with the precedent of this circuit.
Judge, I believe that Ramirez-Fuentes says that the court can discuss it. And
no, it says the court can ignore it.
Well, then I believe that Ramirez-Fuentes is wrong, Judge, and I respectfully...
You don't ask the court to overrule a case on your feet. You brief the issue. If you think we've made a mistake, you brief the issue, but your brief doesn't mention it. Your reply brief doesn't mention it. You know, head in the sand is not a dignified posture for a lawyer.
Judge, with all due respect, my head wasn't in the sand in this case. I believe that my head was properly addressing the fact that the court that the court ignored it.
Yes, just as you've ignored contrary circuit precedent. There's a rule of ethics requiring lawyers to acknowledge and discuss contrary precedent controlling in the jurisdiction.
Yes, Judge. I don't have anything further. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gutierrez. Mr. Smith.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Greg L. Smith, and I represent the appellant Vasily George Husty. May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Husty pled guilty to one count of theft of public money. At the sentencing hearing, he received a sentence of 1 year and a day, making the charge an aggravated felony that all but ensures his deportation. The central issue presented is whether Mr. Husty's trial counsel was ineffective at the sentencing hearing when he misstated the law in the Seventh Circuit, which allows for a sentencing departure based on the collateral consequences of a conviction in exceptional circumstances, and where Mr. Husty received the sentence that makes him ineligible to ever qualify as a legal resident. Now, during the sentencing hearing, Mr. Husty's attorney misstated the law set forth in United States versus Batista. Batista states a downward departure based on collateral consequences of deportation is justified only if circumstances of the case are extraordinary. Not only was the law misstated, but trial counsel failed to argue for a sentence of 364 days or less in the alternative to...
Counsel, do you really want to be raising an attack on the performance of your predecessor on direct appeal?
Judge, I know that the Seventh Circuit frowns upon a ineffective attack.
It's not simply that we have frowns or smiles. It's that this is a no-win situation for counsel. Seventh Circuit was established in 1891, and since 1891, the number of ineffective assistance claims that we have accepted on direct appeal is zero. The reason the number is zero is because you can't possibly prevail on such a claim without an evidentiary hearing at which evidence is taken about why the lawyer did what he did and what prejudice resulted. And so the upshot is that if you raise such an argument on direct appeal, it's going to be resolved against your client, and that will foreclose the possibility of raising it under 2255, because you don't get a second crack at it. That's also the law of this circuit. And so I wonder whether you or your client really wishes to raise this now, since it seems to be, well, the balance of likely outcomes is all against your client.
Judge, we have filed our appeal, and the matter has moved forward, and I am arguing before your...
I know you have filed your appeal. Does your client know that this is an argument he can lose, and which, if he loses now, will foreclose any attempt under 2255?
Judge, I spoke with my client prior to filing the brief, and he was made aware of such.
Your client knows that this will foreclose any 2255 action?
Judge, I believe my client understands that the argument regarding ineffective assistance would be foreclosed.
Okay. And you think this will be the first successful win in 122 years?
Not to be flippant, Judge, but I'm here to give that a shot. I'm here to argue my case. May I proceed? During the hearing, the attorney for Mr. Husty not only misstated law, but he failed to argue for a lesser sentence of 364 days or less in the alternative to probation. This amounted to ineffective assistance per Strickland versus Washington. First, Mr. Husty's trial counsel was constitutionally deficient. He not only misstated law, but his misapprehension of the law forced him to not even argue that a sentence of 364 days, the difference of 2 days in Judge Norgal's sentence, would profoundly affect his immigration consequences. He also, when he had the opportunity to instruct the court, he gave the court incorrect law. Now, the government argues that this mere slip of a tongue did not amount to a constitutionally deficient performance when judging the overall context of the entire representation. However, the entire intention of Mr. Hoostie's criminal proceeding was to secure a sentence that would not amount to an aggravated felony, which would disqualify him as being able to stay in the United States. The attorney's failure is not only present in not only to present an argument, but also to mistake the law was constitutionally deficient.
Wasn't his sentence 6 months below the lower end of the guideline range?
It was, Your Honor.
And so how could you show prejudice even if there was ineffectiveness?
Well, this is a case where the defendant was 14 years old when he came to the United States. He was 17 when he allegedly engaged in this conduct. He was 18 when he was charged. He was 21 when he entered the plea.
So but for the argument of counsel, but for counsel's presentation, he would have got a sentence two days lower?
Well, that argument was never even brought up in front of Judge Norgal, and I think it was critical that it was, in fact, brought up. It was ignored. If Your Honor reviews the transcript, there's absolutely no mention whatsoever of a downward departure based on Batista, and at best, there is an incorrect citing of what the law is here in the Seventh Circuit regarding exceptional circumstances. We believe exceptional circumstances exist with Mr. Hoostie, and that's why we're making the claim or the argument that we are. Yes, the sentence was 6 months lower, but we're talking about a difference of 48 hours, respectfully. Second, Mr. Hoostie was prejudiced by his counsel's deficient representation, and that we're talking about a two-day departure. Because there was no argument for it, because there was no citing of any law that would allow the court to hang its hat on reducing that sentence from 366 days down to 364, we believe that my client was adequately prejudiced under the law. And I would note that, obviously, 364 days, my client would have to do 100%. That would be a tougher, more stringent sentence, and it would have a greater deterrent effect, as opposed to 366 days, which the court gave my client, and he has to serve 85%. Judge Norgal stated that he didn't want to get involved in any deportation, any type of immigration issues. He didn't want to get involved in that. However, his very sentence belies that fact, because it's a difference of 48 hours, knowing that 366 days would turn the plea into an aggravated felony as opposed to 364 days. That concludes my argument. Is there any additional questions from the panel?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Burke.
May it please the Court, Matt Burke on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not commit procedural error at the sentencings of any of the defendants in this case because the record demonstrates that it considered but simply chose to give little weight to the argument regarding immigration consequences. Turning first to the argument of Vasile George Hoostie and the immigration consequences, when this issue was raised, the District Court specifically stated, I don't want to impose a sentence that would give the impression to others that deportation is at the core or heart of the sentence imposed by the court, which is another way of the District Court saying that it found the argument not persuasive, that it chose deliberately to give the argument little weight, which was within the District Court's discretion to do. The record also includes the District Court's statements at the hearing on Hoostie's Rule 35A motion, in which the District Court went on to say that it was fully advised that there were collateral consequences, immigration consequences, as a result of the guilty plea, that the District Court did consider those consequences at sentencing, but that nonetheless it continued to believe that 1 year and one day was a fair and appropriate sentence. Similarly, at the sentencing of Ovidiu Isaac, when the issue was raised, what the District Court said was that it commented upon specifically the fact that removal to Romania, the defendant's home country, would make it more likely that this defendant would be reunited with his wife and child, which at sentencing, defense counsel highlighted how what he wanted nothing more was to be reunited with his wife and child. And so when you look at the district court statements in context, in their totality, it's clear the district court understood the argument, considered the argument, but chose to give it little weight, which, under this court's precedent, the district court has the discretion to do. Now, turning next to the claim of ineffective assistance raised by Vasile George Hoostie, the claim must be rejected because the record already demonstrates that there was no prejudice. The district court was told prior to Vasile George Hoostie's sentencing by the government that the district court had discretion to consider immigration consequences, but that it simply should not exercise that discretion. At the Rule 35 hearing, the district court acknowledged that it understood that it had discretion. And so, although counsel did misstate the law, the district court was not misled by that. And even further, at the Rule 35 hearing, after defense counsel highlighted the district court's discretion and urged the district court to exercise that discretion, the district court said, I considered this at the sentencing hearing. I believe then, and I continue to believe, that 1 year and one day is a fair and appropriate sentence. So we know from the record as it exists that counsel's misstatement of the law did not alter the sentence, and because there's no prejudice, the claim of ineffective assistance should be rejected. Now, lastly, turning to Ovidio Isaac's arguments regarding leader-organizer, first and foremost, this argument is affirmatively waived. Defense counsel and the defendant, in his written plea agreement, affirmatively stipulated that he led and organized the activity of more than five members of the conspiracy during the course of the conspiracy. That is not merely a forfeiture. That is an affirmative waiver that precludes all appellate review, meaning that this court should reject the defendant's challenge to the leader-organizer enhancement. And even if it had not been waived, the evidence that was presented to the district court was more than sufficient to support the leader-organizer enhancement. It included the defendant's own admission that he recruited at least one other member of the conspiracy, extensive wiretap calls demonstrating that he shared a larger share of the proceeds, that he directed others in what to do with the money, and that the other members of the conspiracy looked to him for guidance and direction. And the only problem that defense counsel raises is the claim that the district court erroneously relied on information. But again, the record shows that the district court did not rely on any of the challenged information. First, the arson of Malika's car, the district court expressly stated, at the government's request, expressly stated that it was not relying on that for any purpose. And regarding the trip to Los Angeles, again, there the district court said this does not affect the guidelines. So because the defendant affirmatively waived this issue, and there's more than sufficient evidence, even if it hadn't been waived, to support the enhancement, that argument should also be rejected. Unless there are further questions from the panel, the government would respectfully...
Thank you, Mr. Byrd.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Gutierrez? Mr. Smith? All right. The case is taken under advisement.